Okay, so what I'd like to talk about tonight is the subject of concentration. And I guess a little bit the reason is that for the last 3 weeks we've talked about, especially the last couple of weeks, about reconciliation, kind of removed from meditation itself. And I wanted to give a talk kind of talking about meditation more, the dynamics, the intricacies of meditation more tonight. And I think many of us can feel when you come and sit here in this room that the awareness practice we do here is nourished by the shared intention, the shared practice of all of us here. There's a kind of stillness and concentration that comes upon the room after we've been here for a little while. And I think if you come into the room late, I think it's probably palpable, that sense of stillness or concentration or effort or engagement. And one of the things that helps nourish and helps support an awareness practice is the mental factor of concentration. And often in our tradition, concentration is often contrasted with mindfulness. And because in Buddhism there's a distinction between two forms of meditation, the mindfulness meditations and the concentration meditations. And we do the mindfulness meditation, therefore we don't do the concentration meditation so much, and so therefore maybe we don't talk about concentration so much. However, concentration is an important element of mindfulness practice also. And it's more perhaps, concentration and mindfulness aren't separate categories that are exclusive of each other. The two different forms of meditation are distinguished more perhaps by the proportion of each in each one. So that in concentration meditations, the proportion of concentration to meditation is in favor, concentration and mindfulness is in favor of concentration. And in mindfulness meditation, the proportion is in favor of mindfulness. But in both meditation practices, mindfulness and concentration is important. A young man who had a bitter disappointment in life went to a remote monastery and said to the abbot, "I am disillusioned with life and wish to attain enlightenment to be freed from these sufferings. But I have no capacity for sticking long at anything. I could never do long years of meditation and study and austerity. I should relapse and be drawn back in the world again, painful though I know it to be. Is there any short way for people like me?" So it's like all of us, right? Here. "There is," said the abbot, "if you are really determined. Tell me, what have you studied, what have you concentrated on most in your life?" "Why, nothing really. We were rich, and I did not have to work. I suppose the thing I was really interested in was chess. I spent most of my time at that." The abbot thought for a moment, and then said to his attendant, "Call such and such a monk and tell him to bring a chessboard and men." The monk came with the board and the abbot set up the men. He sent for a sword and showed it to the two. "O monk, you have vowed obedience to me as your abbot, and now I require it of you. You will play a game of chess with this youth, and if you lose, I shall cut off your head with a sword. But I promise that you will be reborn in paradise. If you win, I shall cut off the head of this man. Chess is the only thing he has ever tried hard at, and if he loses, he deserves to lose his head also." They looked at the abbot's face and saw that he meant it. He would cut off the head of the loser. They began to play. With the opening moves, the youth felt the sweat trickling down to his heels as he played for his life. The chessboard became the whole world, and he was entirely concentrated on it. At first he had somewhat the worst of it, but then the other made an inferior move, and he seized his chance to launch a strong attack. As his opponent's position crumbled, he looked covertly at him. He saw a face of intelligence and sincerity, worn with years of austerity and effort. He thought of his own worthless life and a wave of compassion came over him. He deliberately made a blunder and then another blunder, ruining his position and leaving himself defenseless. The abbot suddenly leaned forward and upset the board. The two contestants sat stupefied. "There is no winner and loser," said the abbot slowly. "There is no head to fall here. Only two things are required." And then he turned to the young man. "Complete concentration and compassion. You have today learnt them both. You are completely concentrated on the game, but then, in that concentration, you could feel compassion and sacrifice. You could feel compassion and sacrifice your life for it. Now stay here a few months and pursue your training in this spirit, and your enlightenment is sure." He did so, and he got it. Yesterday, I live up on Skyline, and we were driving down 84, down towards Woodside, and as we were passing by one moment, we saw below us in the hillside all the smoke coming up. And now smoke in the hillside is not considered very good. So I backed up and looked over the edge, and there was all the smoke coming out of a leaf pile. And there was all these trees kind of hanging over the leaf pile. And so I parked and went to see what was going on and asked if they called the fire department. And there were these two guys kind of running around, not seemingly knowing what to do. So I went down to the leaf pile, and there they had left behind a hose with some water running, but kind of just dribbling kind of on the lawn nearby. And meantime, the big leaf pile, you know, huge leaf pile, was beginning to go up in blazes. And here we were in the hills. So I took the hose and started watering down, and my wife came also, and I gave her the hose, and I took a shovel that was there and started kind of moving the leaves about. And this other guy who had driven by also came down to help. And then the other people in the house came out and started helping. And they pretty much had it under control. And then the fire department came up from Woodside. And the fire chief was the first to show up on the scene. And he looks like probably a very dedicated fireman. But my first impression was, what is this man doing being a fireman? Because he seemed rather unfit, with a big belly, and wearing a very nice white shirt. And I guess he was coming to check it out. But he came and he was very cool. And I actually kind of admired him a little bit for his cool. And he saw that the fire was more or less under control, and he kind of said, kind of congratulated, or kind of explained, "Oh, I see you have it under control." And kind of, there was no blame there, which I thought was great. He didn't kind of find out who was responsible or what had happened, and he kind of congratulated us for kind of taking it under control. And then, so we talked for a little while standing there. It turned out that they had put 3-day-old charcoal ash on top of the leaf pile. And that had been enough, it had still been alive enough. And so we were standing a little bit, and, you know, still smoldering. You know, still, the fire was kind of still happening, kind of smoldering. This leaf pile of smoke was coming up. And the other guy who had parked to come and help started showing real concern that the fire department wasn't doing their job. Because here there were like three of us, but this time with forks and shovels and water and trying to get everything kind of under control. And the other firemen had come down by that time, and they were always kind of standing around, kind of like it was Sunday afternoon and at the barbecue and looking at it. And then so this guy, the other guy who had stopped, said, "You're the professionals, do something. You should be doing this, not us who are civilians." And they kind of looked. And then he got really angry because he was a neighbor, and he was kind of, I think he was really afraid of his own house up the hill. And so he got really kind of beside himself in anger. And at which point he was holding his pitchfork, and he came down from on top of the leaf pile and pointing the pitchfork at the police, at the fire chief, and said, "I'm going to shove this up your, if you don't..." You know, threatening him, which I guess is probably a felony. You know, kind of walking up to him. And the fire chief, he was so cool. You know, he just... uh, he wasn't going to lose his cool for anything. And at which point the guy kind of gave up and left. And what struck me, among many things, was the man with the pitchfork, he was very concentrated. He was very attentive. He was very attentive to the fact that the police chief was not doing anything. And he was very concentrated. The concentration, you could feel it in the tip of the pitchfork. But there was no mindfulness. And I think in that moment of passion, he had no mindfulness of himself and what the larger situation of. And he was kind of blinded by his fear and the adrenaline, which I think it was there for many of us. So he couldn't kind of see the situation was quite under control. And I don't think there was any need to kind of start poking at fire chiefs. But I thought it was a lesson in the limitations of concentration, that it's possible to be very, very concentrated and to lose our sense of presence, or lose our kind of wider perspective of what the situation is all about, and lose our sense of awareness of who we are and what our response is and the reasonableness of our response. So it's very important to cultivate mindfulness. And concentration is pretty useful also, but you could feel it earlier. I think that all of us were very concentrated on taking care of the fire. And if we weren't concentrated, I think, if we were kind of just start talking about the weather or, I don't know what. We really needed our full concentration in order to kind of figure out how to take care of this situation. And it felt, I kind of looked back kind of with a certain amount of joy that maybe only a meditator can have. And the feelings of concentration that were also present when I was so involved. Now, if we take concentration to be the opposite of a distracted or scattered mind, then it is clear that what's needed to keep us from losing touch with our present situation, with ourselves, with our deepest intention perhaps, with what's most precious within us, is the ability to concentrate. Because when we're scattered and quite preoccupied and distracted, there's very little chance to kind of be in touch with what is most precious within us, our deepest intention. And so many of us spend much of the time being distracted from distractions by distractions, is the famous expression. We're pretty distracted, but we're too distracted even to notice we're distracted. Distracted from our distractions by our distractions. And so much of our culture, specializes in trying to get us distracted. I think that the whole advertising industry is based on the fact that they can get us distracted. If we weren't distractible, there wouldn't be billboards on the freeway or whatever. And I think that they kind of, my impression is that all the kind of commercial input we get, the commercial advertisement we get, has a quality of agitating the mind, of scattering the mind, not letting it be settled and concentrated, both with the kind of images that come our way, that kind of grab our attention and scatter it in a sense, but also with the greed and the desire that those images are designed to try to stimulate. One of the first insights people have when they do mindfulness practice is, or almost any kind of meditation practice, is how out of control their mind seems. Many people, when they first practice, before they've practiced, have never taken really any serious time to look at their mind and their thoughts and how it works. And it's a shock to find out the kind of thoughts you have, the kind of concerns, and how it seems to be going on in its own speed and its own life without any kind of input or control on our part. And a lot of people get discouraged about meditation when they have this first understanding. But you should take heart, because it's really the first beginning of insight, beginning of understanding. And it's understandable that it's difficult at first, because I added up the hours in today, and apparently there's about 9 million. If by the time you've reached the age of 30, you've lived about 9 million hours. And many people can reach the age of 30 without any attempt to try to understand or quiet down or control the random scattered thoughts that we have all the time. And if we spend 9 million hours in one mode like that, and then we sit down for an hour to meditate, the 9 million, you know, versus one is quite an imbalance. And so it's necessary to be a little bit kind and patient and not be in a hurry to try to break the old habits. And it's quite, you know, when you consider that kind of balance, proportion, it's quite phenomenal how quickly we do get settled. You know, we don't have to do anything near, you know, equal time on the meditation cushion to make up for it. Another way of referring to concentration is that it's a quality of undivided attention. And so many of us have our attention seemingly divided in many different things, in many different places. And I wonder, a very interesting exercise to do, I think, is to go home, spend a day, and try to notice how many times in one day you're doing two things at once. And I think probably we'd be surprised at what proportion of the day is spent that way. How many of you read or listen to the radio or watch television when you eat your breakfast? Let's see, how many of you do something like that? Less than I thought. And how many people watch television when they eat dinner? And how many people, there's one that wants to admit it. What? And you know, then there's you know, listening to the radio on when you're driving, or there's talking on the telephone when you're driving and shaving with the other hand. Three things at once. And how many people have a portable phone? You know, not in the house, kind of the house kind of type. That's actually not so many. Now, how many of you will go around and like cook or clean or do something while you're talking on the phone? You know, you might as well kind of be efficient, right?
No, but some people talk on the phone a long time.
So you better, they have to, in order to get something done, you have to. And some things you can do, you know, as long as they don't hear anything. Some certain private activities which you can do on the portable phone. No one knows. As long as you don't flush, they'll never know.
The hard thing is to do two things well.
It's hard to do two things well. But I think the point I want to make is that I think it's quite common for people to try to do two things at once, to have their attention scattered and broken up. And perhaps it's okay thing to do, but it reinforces a tendency to have the mind become scattered and not settled on one place. And one of the things that's very helpful for any kind of spiritual life, I believe, and it's often, this is a device that's kind of perennially given, is to practice doing one thing at a time. Because if you do one thing at a time and settle your mind on one thing, there's a possibility of allowing the mind to settle and become quiet, which is usually not possible when you're doing two or three things at a time. You can get very settled doing two or three things at a time. It depends on how you do it. So when I was a fast food cook, you had to do like 10 or 12 things at once. And almost, you know, I surrendered to the situation. And actually my mind became very, very quiet. It was like a wonderful dance. So there are times when it works. I don't want to put it down exactly. But the important thing is to pay attention to what the quality of your mind is. Quality of your attention, quality of your heart, of your body. And I can feel in myself that the days where I try to do two things at once, like talk on the phone and clean the house or whatever, I actually feel like I'm losing touch with everything. Losing touch with my body, losing touch with my mind, losing touch with my friend on the phone. And I feel so much more settled if I do one thing at a time. Just talk on the phone when I'm talking, and when it's finished, just clean. And it's possible in the long term you're more efficient that way, usually. Yes.
I just wanted to say, and the friend on the phone knows that you have lost touch.
Probably, yeah.
That's when my anger comes. Too hard for me. You know, when they're not present.
Yeah. So not present. So we all know what it's like when a friend is not present for us. Someone's not present for us.
Sometimes I hear the keyboard of the computer.
But if they call me while I'm cooking dinner, you know, I'll just, you know, otherwise, you know, the onions will burn.
In corporate life, it's an advantage, supposedly, to multitask. I mean, this is something that people think is terrific.
You know, it's possible that it's more efficient. It's possible you can get a lot more done by doing two or three things at once and having your attention divided. But is it worth it? Is it worth it for your spiritual life, or for your inner life, or for your mind? What is the consequence on your mind, or on your heart, or on your body, or on your relationships to make that a habit? And you know, one of the interesting things to do is to meditate after work. Meditate before work and after work, and see what activities at work how that affects your meditation afterwards. And it could be that you'd be much more settled for your meditation if you didn't multitask, if you were less efficient. But it's a heresy in America to suggest that you should be less efficient. You know, people like that get burned to the stake almost. It's very... just laid off. I want to give a talk at some point about work in America, because it's a source of... a great amount of suffering in much of our culture, I think. And I don't know if it's more in this area than in other places, but it's just so much suffering goes into work, and what we take for granted has to be.
Would you let us know ahead of time so we can bring the right people?
Also, divided attention tends to, I believe, divide the body from the mind too much, because the body can really, except if you know you're in a fast food restaurant, kind of dancing with your food. Often, when you're doing two things at once, your body can, for the most part, only be with one thing at a time. So, if your mind is kind of on the phone and your body is cleaning, how much can your body really be present for the cleaning? And then your mind and body is split. So divided attention tends also to lead to a division between the mind and the body. And one of the things that concentration is sometimes said to create, it's said to unify the mind, but also to unify the mind and the body. And again, my belief is that you cannot really mature in a spiritual practice unless you begin to allow the mind and the body to become unified, to come together. And it's not something that's so difficult to do. It's just mostly giving the mind-body half a chance to do it on its own. But if we've constantly divided our attention, constantly busy and rushing around and frantic, it's very hard to allow that unification to happen. Also, when the attention is divided, or there's a habit of dividing the attention, you're much more likely to become bored, or have fear of getting behind, or greed for more and more activity. I think boredom is a big thing. If you're not, haven't learned how to be fully present, but have split yourself so you're kind of half present for everything, then I think it's much easier to get bored because you don't feel fully connected. And full connection is what's, I think, where the preciousness of our life resides, being really engaged and connected with our life. Also, when attention is divided, there is a conflict or competition for how to use both our energy, our vital energy, and also our attention. And it's much more easy to become fatigued and inattentive and restless when there's kind of a struggle, inner struggle between where we should send our attention. There are two types of concentration that we talk about in Buddhism. And concentration maybe can be understood as a steadiness of attention. of placing the mind steadily on a particular place and keeping it there. There are two types. One is called fixed or one-pointed concentration. And that's where you take attention and place it on an object, and you fix it there and don't let it waver at all from that object. And if you can do that, the attention kind of gets more and more focused on that object. All the other objects that are around it, objects of attention, kind of fade away from awareness. And so your various sense doors become quieter and quieter until you don't hear anything anymore, you don't see anything anymore, you don't smell anything. It's just you're completely focused on this particular object. And this particular one-pointed concentration is described as it being a very unifying activity in terms of unifying the focus of the mind. And the result of this unification is tremendous states of bliss. Some of the peak experience of happiness that are possible for a human being. Yes?
You're saying concentration on a particular object, you mean looking at?
It just doesn't have to be looking. The eyes can be closed. You take one of your sense doors, and it could be the inner eye, which is, or it could be a mantra. You're saying a mantra, or it could be any object that you concentrate on. You concentrate that one thing exclusively, and let all other concerns fall away. If you do that well enough, you have access to some of the highest stages of possible happinesses, or joys, or blisses, or raptures that is probably possible for a human being. Very, very high states. And so it's very appealing to do that, to do those kinds of practices. But in the Buddhist tradition, those levels of concentration have their uses. They're not disrespected, but they're understood not to bring wisdom or understanding. Because when you're very, very concentrated in a one-pointed way, all the reactive tendencies of the mind, the habitual ways we have of working, are on hold. And because they're on hold, we can get very blissful. But as soon as we relax the concentration, the old patterns come back. And you've cultivated no understanding of the patterns, and so you're just as miserable as you were before. The other type of concentration is a kind of concentration we cultivate when we do mindfulness practice. And this, the technical term for this is momentary concentration. And this is a kind of concentration which settles very completely, very clearly on a particular object of experience as it arises, but doesn't hold on to it, doesn't fix onto it. Will settle on it fully and then go on to, and when something else arises, go to that and put yourself on that. And it's considered to be, in some sense, a more difficult concentration, because it's easier to rest your mind on one thing. But if you have changing objects, you have to continually, in some sense, resettle yourself on each one. Both of them involve staying in the present moment. And the operative, I think, the important thing in meditation is to learn to stay in the present moment and learn what that means for the different kinds of experiences we can have. To learn what it means to stay in the present moment for physical experiences, for emotional experiences, for thinking. Whatever we're doing, whatever's happening to us, whatever we're experiencing, we can find some way to be present for it as an event in the present moment. In the momentary concentration of mindfulness, we're fully being present in the present moment, but we're allowing the present moment to flow and change as it wishes without trying to control it. Whereas the one-pointed concentration, there's a tremendous element of control involved. In mindfulness, you can maybe say there's control, but you're only controlling your attention to stay in the present, and then there's letting go of control within the present, letting things come up clearly. So someone said, you know, we know when someone's not present for us on the phone. I think we have a sense of what it's like when we lose someone's presence. You know, when someone's really present for us, sometimes we say that, oh, it's so nice to be with that person because the person was really present. I think of mindfulness as kind of going to maybe like a party and shaking people's hands. And mindfulness is coming up and you go and you're really present for someone and you shake their hands and you're really there for them. And then when you're finished shaking and finished greeting them, then you go off and greet someone else. And you know what it's like to go to a cocktail party and you shake someone's hand, and before you kind of really, you know, start gripping a little bit, the person's off, you know, saying hello to someone else. And you get this wet, limp kind of, you know, hand. It's, you know, it's a real drag. And you know when someone is too present because they squeeze your hand too hard. And mindfulness is really, it's like just fully being there in a respectful way and really shaking someone's hand. So what is your experience right now? And can you really connect to it fully? And this is where the concentration, can you really concentrate on that one thing? Can you place the attention there and sustain it at least long enough so you feel fully connected? What some people do who are mindfulness students is they skim along the surface of their experience. I know some people will follow their breath because they've been told that's kind of where it's at. So they're constantly trying to follow their breath in meditation. But they've heard the mindfulness instructions, so, which says, pay attention to the other things that happen when they're predominant. So they kind of dutifully kind of notice when something else happens and kind of check it off and run back to their breath. And they feel like it's done with. And it's checking things off and kind of skimming along the surface is not what mindfulness is about. Mindfulness is about penetrating deeply, settling deeply into our life, and really contacting it and feeling it in the present moment. So when an itch arises, you don't simply kind of just check it off dutifully and say, an itch, and you run back to the breath because it's uncomfortable to stay with an itch. You actually allow your awareness to settle in the area of the itch and really feel it. If you feel an emotion, you let yourself really settle and connect with that emotion, feeling what it's like. To really connect. And two aspects of concentration in the classic texts is the first part of concentration is placing the mind on the object. And the second is sustaining the attention long enough to really connect with it. So, for example, with the breath, we place our awareness on the breath. We really place it there. We don't just kind of keep ourselves removed, kind of watching it at a distance. We really place it. We rest the awareness on the breath. And then sustain it there. Let it stay there for a little while, really to connect. It doesn't have to be, you know, forever, but really so your awareness can kind of sink in. Upandita, my teacher, he liked to talk about, he used the analogy of using a fork eating broccoli. And they don't have broccoli in Burma, but he said that if you push the fork too weakly into the broccoli, you're not going to penetrate well enough to be able to pick it up. But if you push too hard, you know, the broccoli falls apart. So you have to kind of, you know, he said you have to kind of settle the mind well enough on an object in order to really feel it and sense it intimately, but not to kind of destroy it, and not to, you know, so you kind of add a remove from it. Really settle and be present for it. It's said in Buddhist psychology that in every moment of mental life, there is an element of concentration there. That concentration is kind of one of the constant factors of the mind. And so, for example, this man who had the pitchfork, he was really concentrated, but he had no mindfulness. What we're trying to do in mindfulness practice, one way of describing mindfulness practice, is we're simply trying to notice where our mind's attention is, where the mind is naturally concentrated on. So if you're following your breath, and you're trying to concentrate on the breath, but really what's going on is you're thinking about Tahiti, what's happening is primarily your natural inclination is to concentrate on the thoughts about Tahiti. So mindfulness practice is about noticing where your concentration actually is. And if you can notice where your concentration is, then there's a way, it's kind of like the Aikido of mindfulness, then you can just hook up your mindfulness to the concentration that's already there and allow yourself to settle into that experience as a present experience in the present moment. So if you can be aware of thinking about Tahiti, the fantasies about Tahiti, if you can be aware of that as happening in this room right now, in this body, then you're in the present moment and there's no problem. And you're concentrated because you're already concentrated. Is this making sense what I'm saying? So one way of describing mindfulness practice, which is a very gentle, I think, kind of non-violent way of understanding it, is we try to focus on the breath. And when it becomes difficult to focus on the breath, we try to notice where our concentration really is. And then we place our attention there. And then it should be easy to get concentrated because there's already the interest. Also, we're a little bit reluctant in mindfulness circles to talk a lot about concentration, because when people hear about how important concentration is, they'll do maybe commonly two things. They'll either strive really hard and get a headache. And, you know, and striving, if you strive too hard, it's really difficult to really settle and get calm and concentrate in the appropriate way. Or they won't get concentrated at all, and they feel discouraged. And they'll feel, oh, this is hopeless to do this meditation. I'm a really bad meditator. Or whatever, have some kind of self-criticism. So we don't want to say too much. Mostly we tell you, talk about relax and accept the present moment and just be generally mindful. But one of the beautiful things about mindfulness practice is that if you have enough presence of mind to criticize yourself for not being a good enough mindfulness practitioner, you have already plenty enough presence of mind to be mindful. Because to criticize yourself, you have some presence of awareness to know what's going on, to recognize what's happening, to recognize things that are a little bit frustrating, whatever. So you already have enough mindfulness. So why criticize yourself? The criticism at this point is kind of not really true. So if you find yourself wanting to criticize yourself for not being good enough in mindfulness, then you do the Aikido part. You say, oh, but I am present. And you notice what's happening. So it's one of these practices you can't do wrong. Because if you think you're doing it wrong, what you haven't noticed is you have enough presence of mind. And so what you can do then is celebrate. Like, so if you've been distracted for a while and lost, then you're really lost and gone. And there's no problem when you're lost, right? Because you're too lost to even know there's a problem. So what's the problem? And at some point, you wake up enough and you notice that you're lost. You were lost, that you were distracted. At that point, you're awake. You've noticed something. So what some people will do is they'll criticize themselves. But what they're doing when they criticize themselves is they're criticizing something that happened in the past. And it might have been 2 seconds ago in the past, but it's still in the past. And just as might as well have been 2 years ago. And how many of you criticize yourself for being a little bit distracted 2 years ago? You don't bother because it's kind of silly. But you bother a lot because of 2 seconds ago. It's both of them are in the past. So like one other teacher, Mary Orr, she says when you notice that you've been distracted, you should celebrate the fact that now you've noticed something and you're present again. And I think that's fine to celebrate. But I think even celebrating is kind of a little bit retrospective thinking. And so you shouldn't even celebrate. You should simply start practicing where you're at. Very straightforward in a steady way. So I'll end with a few of the classic suggestions that the tradition gives for how to get concentrated. One of the things they say is often you shouldn't try too hard to get concentrated. That concentration is not necessarily something you create or do, but it's something that arises out of creating the right conditions for yourself. One of the right conditions is to have a regular practice. Just practice in a regular and steady way. That helps build concentration. If you practice every day for a certain amount of time, especially if you practice every day at a certain time of day, that continuity of habit will help build and support your ability to get concentrated. If you go on a retreat, like a long retreat, a day-long or week-long retreat, if you very steadily and calmly and loyally follow the schedule that's offered, without worrying about getting concentrated or worrying about anything, the very effect of being engaged regularly in the practice in this regular, methodical way will tends to create the conditions for concentration to arise. It's said also that having a clean, orderly environment to meditate in is very useful for concentration. So some people like to take a little part of their home and reserve it for meditation, like a corner of the bedroom, and put a meditation cushion mat there and keep it kind of nice and orderly. And maybe put something there that you can sit down and look at that might inspire you a little bit in your spiritual practice, in your mindfulness practice. Some people will use a figure of a Buddha, or it could be anything. It's also said in the classic texts that if you want to get concentrated, it helps if you're wearing clean clothes. Also, it's helpful to be clean yourself. So taking a bath before you meditate is supposed to help your ability to get concentrated. It also helps to relax the body, to be a little bit relaxed. So if you can do things that help you relax a little bit before you meditate, that's helpful. So you get some of that in the initial period of meditation. It tends to be relaxing, usually in the beginning. Another thing that's useful is to get, if you ever do feel yourself a little bit concentrated in meditation, to take some time and get a sense of the flavor or the texture or the quality of being that's present when you're concentrated. Because when you're concentrated, you probably feel a little bit calm. You might feel a little bit happy, perhaps, a little bit spacious, a little bit open. You might feel a little bit unified in the body. Or you might feel more in your body. You might feel a bit embodied. So to kind of get a sense of what things, those things are like. And then it's possible to either notice when hints of those start becoming present. And if you can kind of catch hints of them when they first become present because you're familiar with them, you can at times allow yourself to relax or let go into them more. So if you feel like a hint of what it's like to be spacious or open, then sometimes it's possible to relax and let go into it. Or if you realize that it's very difficult to get, I believe, healthily concentrated if you're not embodied. If you see that, then you might want to surrender or let go into your body when you're going to meditate. And if you can do that act of surrender into your body, it's a lot more easy, it's a lot easier to be present. Also, concentration is supported by accepting things as they are. To not struggle against things, be in conflict with things, or trying to change things, or trying to criticize things, or push things away. But if we accept things as they are, that also helps create a condition for becoming concentrated. And also, concentration is supported by simplicity. The simpler you can be, the more settled and undivided you can be with your attention. And I'll end now with an exercise that I'll suggest that you do if you're interested. And that is spend a day being as simple as possible, but not at the expense of not doing the things you need to do for that day. So there might be things you need to do. You might need to go to work, or you might need to clean up, or go shopping, or talk to friends, or there might be things you need to do. But try to cut out everything that you don't need. Everything that can be considered extraneous for that day. See how simple you can be and still leave a normal life. And then see, at the end of the day, what the effect of that day is on your quality of your being. And I think that's a very interesting exercise to do. And you might decide after doing a day like that, that it's so worthwhile that maybe you want to be that way more often. Because so many of us spend so much of our day doing things which are unnecessary for our general well-being, even for our efficiency. And just simply kind of stopping to do the extra stuff and keeping ourselves more simple. I would think that many of us would find ourselves feeling much more intimate with ourselves and the world around us if we did that. So concentration is an important element of mindfulness practice, and the way that perhaps I would like you to think, translate it into your own practice, is mindfulness practice is very much supported by taking the practice seriously, by diligence, and really being inspired to really engage yourself in the practice. And if you can do that, I think that you'll understand the world of mindfulness much better, and this really precious quality of attention will become something that you will safeguard and enjoy, and which you'll share with others. So I hope that that was not confusing to talk about concentration, and I wish you well.